Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that can and will change. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my co-host is Bearded Wonder Steve Haynes.
Hello.
Also with me is future Prime Minister Nicky Brennan.
Hello.
And Magic Grandpa John Cotton.
I'm glad you've let me out this late.
3 years into his Labour leadership, Ed Miliband was talking about sexy terms like pre-distribution, whilst 3 years into Tony Blair's leadership, Labour won a landslide election. Unusually for the shy and retiring Tony Blair, who often doesn't make interventions into British politics, he made an intervention into the debate in the Labour Party recently, saying that the party was now lost for the moderates. We're going to talk about whether he's right, whether that's a good thing, and look back at 3 years of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. Now, we've been talking about Jeremy Corbyn on this podcast for 2 years, and loyal long-term listeners will know that most of our Corbyn-related predictions have been wrong. And, John, both you and I voted for Liz Kendall in 2015, which makes this one of the more unrepresentative of Labour Party podcasts.
We're almost 50% of the room, right?
18 times more than the actual... Looking back at that election in 2015, there were four candidates. Andy Burnham, who listeners may recall is from the North, and that was his big selling point. Yvette Cooper went on holiday for most of the election. And so it was really only Corbyn and Kendall who were kind of putting actual interesting things to say. Both of them were reactions to Labour's unexpected defeat in 2015. And the Corbyn view, broadly, was that Labour lost because it wasn't radical enough, it needed to do more to energise leftist centre voters who were voting for the Greens or who hadn't bothered voting at all. Whereas the Kendall viewpoint was quite different. The Kendall viewpoint was saying, well, Labour didn't lose an election to the Conservative Party because they weren't left-wing enough, and saying that they had to move towards that treasured centre ground, park tanks on it and appeal to businesses, middle-class voters, that sort of thing. Does the election last year essentially prove that the Kendall thesis is wrong, the Corbyn thesis is right?
You have to look at the result of that election, and from the perspective of people like myself, say, yeah, to an extent there's a mea culpa that we have to do around this. I do think that there's deeper stuff that when you compare 2015 and 2017, though. I think there's a continuity in terms of the manifestos, and I think to an extent it's not just about policy, but there's an issue here about authenticity. And I think Ed Miliband had got himself into a place where he was just not seen as consistent or authentic by a lot of the electorate, fairly or unfairly. That's where he was. Other factors played into this as well. So we had the impact of the Brexit vote. A lot of the stuff around austerity really began to bite post-2015 and concentrate people's minds. Just in terms of conversations I'd have in doorsteps in the run-up to 2015 where people were not perhaps getting the impact of cuts on austerity in the same way that they were 2 years later. And I think that's a factor as well. And it chimed very well with the stance that Labour was then taking in the run-up to 2017 on austerity. It was clearer, I think, about that. Yeah, I think it's a slightly more complicated answer than were we, you know, several degrees to the left or several degrees to the right. But clearly, I think, you know, Corey, you and I were representative of a strand of thinking at that point that missed something that was happening.
We've done a podcast, Steve, on how the Labour right over the past year have completely, essentially, gone insane.
Yeah, they've not really offered anything meaningful to the internal party debate or anything on the national stage since Corbyn been elected leader. The best they came up with was Owen Smith, a man that no one had ever heard of.
Can we please call him by his actual name of Badasaurus Rex, the man who spent the election campaign joking about the length of his own penis, as I think...
Yes, that is his formal title.
Yeah,
they've offered nothing, even in terms of ideas, policies. I think we briefly discussed Chris Leslie's policy booklet that was released a few weeks back, which is, I think John described it as a cure for narcolepsy.
Absolutely, I slept very well after reading it.
They're surprised that they haven't made any inroads in terms of in the internal vote,
because I suppose if we're thinking about the centre ground of the Labour Party, and just in terms of Labour members, the impression I get is that most Labour members essentially are, I think someone described it to me as almost like their spiritual kind of son is almost like Ed Miliband, and that it's, but early Ed Miliband, that kind of after he won in 2010 in the leadership election, and was quite radical, was taking on Murdoch, early stages of his leadership did seem like it would be quite radical. And I think what often gets forgotten is that it wasn't that Corbyn didn't win because of entryism. Corbyn won because Labour members in 2015 voted for him as well. I think part of that is because a lot voted for Ed, thinking he would be more radical, thinking he'd be more left-wing. And then ultimately, that manifesto in 2015 was a little bit of a disappointment, especially their position on austerity.
Yeah, they weren't an anti-austerity party. And I think looking at a vote, being a voter back in 2015, it was one of those kind of hold your nose and vote Labour. I didn't vote Labour because I was enthused about voting Labour. I did it because I saw it was my duty. Our worst Labour government is a lot better than any Tory government. And I felt like austerity was biting and maybe there'd be some kind of comeback on that. But when I was watching Corbyn speak in the Labour leadership, it was like a new thing. We were talking about anti-austerity. We were talking about things that I believe in. And I think it was a completely change in direction. And I think the other three candidates were just business as usual. In regards to Ed Miliband, I think since he's not been Labour leader, he's gone a bit more to the left. I think he's kind of showing himself a bit more. He's a lot sassier.
Yeah, and I think what you've brought up there with Ed Miliband is kind of actually goes back to what John was talking about authenticity. Mm. This is actually the real Ed Miliband we're seeing now. You know, sassy Twitter Ed Miliband is
where
actually
was that
who
guy
he is.
When we needed him?
Exactly.
He was eating a bacon sandwich, John. The country will never forgive him.
But, you know, this is a guy who's now hosting radio call-in shows and doing death metal growls or being taught how to do them by the lead singer of Napalm Death on BBC Radio 2. He actually has a personality. One of the aspects of this that's interesting is, and it's a wider shift, and it's not just about Labour, because Theresa May has been a victim of this on the Tory side as well, is that move towards, we don't want cookie cutter politicians anymore. Mm. We want people with an actual personality. We want people who can just give us a straight answer, yes or no, when asked. And that's something that Miliband didn't do. Could he have done it? Probably. But I don't think his team, or indeed the people that were advising him in any capacity, realised quite where we were at that point. And as a result, he just came across as really fake and very inauthentic.
Yeah, am I tough enough?
Was
not a good move. Ed Miliband's not one of the people that I've gone through their voting record in detail, but I suppose you could have somebody that was quite right-wing, that was authentic and voted for, that it was authentic for them on the Labour right. I think Jeremy Corbyn's voting record, when we look at things like the Iraq war, we look at things like welfare reform, I think that does him justice, and that shows, I think, definitely how the party's shifted. If we look at welfare bill in 2015, we were still voting for austerity. We weren't voting for welfare reform for people. And I think stuff like that is what does him good in people's eyes.
And I think that welfare vote in 2015 is the key moment in that leadership election.
Absolutely.
In prep for this, I read Alex Nunes' The Candidate, which is
very good book.
Genuinely really good. Like, obviously very partisan from a very Corbynite point of view. But I think he does quite well trace the history of Corbyn's victory in the campaign and the wider movement behind him. And although one of the things that Nunn says is that actually, if you look in terms of CLP nominations and which candidate was getting traction, Corbyn was probably ahead in terms of those nominations even before that vote. But I think after that vote, where Andy Burnham, I mean, you'll be shocked to hear this, listeners, flip-flopped and blew with the wind a little bit. And then,
did he abstain?
I think he abstained in the end.
I think everybody abstained. All of the leadership candidates other than Corbyn abstained.
It goes back to the point of austerity, where Paul Krugman, the American economist who was talking about a lot about how we need to oppose austerity, talked about what he called very serious people. And you had to look tough and you had to look credible by accepting austerity, accepting there had to be cuts to be made. It comes back to the Kendall view, I suppose, and the view on the right of why Labour lost in 2015, which was we were seen as being the party of people on benefits. And so George Osborne does a very obvious tactical trap that Harry Harman, as Labour acting leader, walked us into. And she tried to take the damage, I think, thinking that she might as well take that hit rather than the Labour leaders. As you said, Nikki, I suppose Corbyn shows actually a way is possible. You can actually have a Labour leader that opposes those sort of things and doesn't do the electoral calculation. Whereas the impression you got with Ed Miliband and Ed Balsman here with Shadow Chancellor is they're all doing those electoral calculations. In what I have to say, just to bring factionism into this for a moment, is a little bit of a very Brownite way, in the way that when Gordon Brown was asked by Mumsnet what's his favourite biscuit, like he couldn't give a straight answer because it's almost like his brain was so scrambled he couldn't give an electorally convincing answer. And so I think that welfare vote is when the door is shut on any alternative candidate winning other than Corbyn, I think.
Wouldn't disagree with that.
And he wasn't there in like a suit and... Well, he was in his suit, but he didn't have his tie done up and he's on his bicycle and he's just...
Very Jeremy Corbyn smart, yeah, rather than actual business smart, which is how everybody else presents themselves.
And he had queues of people come to see him speak. It's just...
Maybe it's another example of me getting things wrong, but I remember thinking about the rallies and the election and what have you and thinking this feels like 1983, when Michael Foot was giving rallies to tens of thousands of people. At the moment, I'm reading Bernard Donoghue's diaries, who was working for Harold Wilson in Number 10. He talked about the first election in 1974. They're all Wilson's inner campaign staff are talking about how the BBC basically seems like an extra campaigner for Heath. Donoghue himself, when he sees the BBC in the election, says, "Oh, it's surprising to see you BBC journalists here, because I thought you'd all be out on election day canvassing for Ted Heath." And can you imagine if someone like Matt Czar-Cousins had said that in 2017? It'd be an absolute scandal. And the Wilson seemed to think, well, I'm not sure about the polls, but the reaction at my rallies and my speeches is going really well. So I think actually I'm not sure the polls are right on this one. And so maybe it's that actually part of the Labour right is scarred by the 1980s and everyone goes back to the 1980s and everything through Labour was always seen through that prism, whereas actually it was interesting looking at a slightly different precedent at a different time. So actually, Corbyn's leadership doesn't then seem as a failure as you'd assumed it would be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot in that. And I think it is that thing around there's always the temptation to fight the last war rather than the next one. You know, and I'm coming from the generation that might say my first election I was ever involved in was 1992. And I think, you know, being scarred by the going into an election, we thought we were going to end 13 years of, because, you know, there's no way they were going to win four in a row, you know, 13 long years of Tory government and et cetera, et cetera. And I think the impact of not only losing that election, but losing that election fairly substantially, if you look at the percentage share of the vote, that had an impact on a generation of Labour activists. And I think you view the world through that lens, and I think what's happened over the last couple of years has been a really interesting corrective to perhaps some of the assumptions that I and others had made.
Shall we talk about Tony then? So
we need to talk about Tony.
We do, because he keeps hanging out with fascists, yeah. Which is a problem.
Nobody says anything.
As if somehow the public perception of Tony Blair could drop even lower. In an interview with Nick Robinson about a month ago, or two or three weeks ago, talked about he wasn't sure if it was possible for moderates to win back power in the Labour Party, talked about the profound change that Labour had gone through under Jeremy Corbyn, essentially says that the party is now in the hands of the far left. How seriously and accurately are we going to take that?
So my major gripe about a lot of this is just how, basically, it's the use of the term moderate. Like all of the coverage on this, and I think even Blair himself basically said, oh yeah, the moderates can't take back the party now. And it's like, what are you classing as a moderate here? Because if you mean Blairite in the sense of, you know, actual disciples to Tony Blair, like Chris Leslie and all of that, yeah, 100%, then they're not going to be winning in the next leadership election. But if you mean actual moderates, which is basically everybody of the soft left within Labour, probably does actually include, to agree, some of the more traditional Blairites, like, say, Liz Kendall or whatever. Those people probably can have influence and can win leadership elections. They just need to do it in a different way than they did before. Blair's definition of moderate is an interesting one, Because I think he means anybody who's not basically him.
I think it's quite interesting with this whole kind of term of Blairite and moderate. I think a lot of the time in kind of left momentum circles, some activists will call anybody that doesn't agree with Corbyn or will criticise Corbyn a Blairite, which is quite... Like Tom Watson will be a Blairite, which is quite interesting.
Gordon Brown's a Blairite these days,
yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's very helpful. On the party being different, I think if you have so many new members, which we have obviously had under Jeremy Corbyn, a party is not going to be the same. We need to obviously transform the party to kind of deal with all these new members and make them a campaign force. I think, we're the largest progressive party now. And I think people just want democracy in the party. If you're a member, you want to be able to vote in your CLP meetings, you want to say who's leader. And I don't really think that's quite a radical thing. I think Blair still kind of wants a grip. He'll say things like, and the media will say things like, Jeremy Corbyn's got his grip on the party. But again, it's just democratic elections, and I think that's what needs to be remembered.
Firstly, I think that whenever Tony descends upon us to give his thoughts, I'm reminded of that letter that Clement Attlee sent to, I forget who it was.
Harold Lasky?
I think it was, yeah. A period of silence on your part would be welcome. I think that's probably the most sensible thing you could do. Are we a different party? Well, inevitably we will be. We're not the same. You know, the Labour Party in 1997 was not the same one of 1977, and ditto, 20 years prior. But I don't get the sense that there's been such a dramatic transformation that it's so different from the party I joined 26 years ago. Many of the same people I've known throughout that time are still part of it and active within it. Newer members who've joined, I don't think there's a massive difference in terms of our core values and the things that we want to achieve. We might have differences over the route by which we get there, but that's, all part of a vibrant democratic party. So I think these things can be overplayed. I think there's a really dangerous thing, like you say, Steve, about labels and what do we mean by some of this stuff around moderate and
it's very divisive.
Yeah.
It's there to divide, I think, and cause disunity in the party. And I think that's why Blair's wheeled out a lot of the time. Labour will be doing well in the polls, there'll be a good policy announcement, and here we go, Tony Blair's here again to divide us and make us have internal arguments.
Well, ironically, we're all quite united, I think, on the point. What has changed, I think, over the last 2 or 3 years is the influence that the members have on the party. Yeah. That's partly because there's more that have joined. But it's also partly because the system to elect leaders changed in 2015. Now, that was done by Ed Miliband, usually at the behest of the Labour right. Like, since the early 80s, the right has been pushing for one member, one vote in internal leadership elections, usually to try and weaken the grip of the trade unions. And I think they also were quite influenced by the French Socialist Party and the primaries they have.
Whatever happened to the French Socialist Party?
I think they got about the same percentage of the vote as Liz Kendall got, actually.
I think they outpolled her, actually.
I'm thinking of Hollande's approval ratings, aren't I?
I don't think centrism is doing very well in France.
No. I think going to my earlier point that essentially most Labour members, the centre ground of them is essentially just early Ed Miliband. If you look at NEC elections from the past 10, 15 years, as you were saying earlier, before we started recording, Nicky, actually the left slate's always done pretty well on NEC elections. It's not the right. Anne Black, who was on the left slate, she was topping the poll for decades, wasn't she?
Yeah, quite regularly.
Mm. When you're talking about, like, is it a different party, looking at the kind of like the NEC and the different various, like, elected committees and things like that is probably quite a good way to do it. One, in terms of, the percentage of the votes that they've got, but also the faces that are appearing there. So when you say, is it a new party, if it is, you would expect there to be a myriad of different faces in a lot of those roles and those key positions, different people running for elections and actually winning them. And yet, when it boils down to it, an awful lot of them are the same old, same old. And even if they haven't been on the NEC before, like, I don't know when John Lansman first got on, for instance.
Well, so John
earlier this year.
Yeah.
Well, and John Lansman's been involved. He ran Tony Benn's deputy leadership campaign, didn't he, in 81? Yeah. So he's been around the Labour circles for decades.
Even if they've only just been elected recently to one of these sorts of roles, in reality, a lot of them are still, old hands at internal Labour Party politics in many different ways. So we're not actually seeing a new generation of people coming through. We're just seeing a different load of individuals from the same old groups as before.
I think what I will say about what is different in the party is what I saw in the 2017 general election, where you had so many people actually door knocking and turning up for campaign sessions and actually there to help Labour get elected. And it was a lot of young people. We had grime artists coming out to support the Labour Party. I don't know if that's happened before.
Grime artists for Wilson was a very short note.
Yeah. They're all behind George Brown on they this. Were
maybe colliery workers.
But yeah, that's quite an exciting thing, seeing like 16, 17-year-olds wanting to come out and knock the doors for Labour. And it's something that I saw in Northfield. We did, as Momentum, we did a campaign for Richard Burden to keep his seat, and we had mass people coming to Northfield at a regular basis. And having young people come out, being out on election day, and it was like, there were so many people there to knock the doors for Labour.
I think in terms of those new members, and thinking about a new party, where we did a podcast on looking at Frank Field and Kate Hoey, and since that podcast was recorded, I think Frank Field's resigned the whip. If you look at why the Labour Party's changed, I think a lot of it actually is the social reforms the Blair government brought in, because denigrate tone though, as we do, his government did some good stuff, and especially on social legislation. And so if we're looking at how the broad church of Labour's been changed, actually now Labour's a much more explicitly social liberal party than it was probably 10, 20, 30 years ago. I would say, as a social liberal, that's probably a good thing. And given that society as a whole has got more socially liberal, more accepting of homosexuality and gay marriage, more accepting of those from different races as well, a lot of that is because we had 13 years of a socially liberal Labour government. In that sense, it's inevitable that those younger people are going to come in and see MPs who are pro-gun rights, in favour of fox hunting, not so down with abortion, and go, not sure about that, really.
I think, again, that absolutely right.
Maybe finish off with, do we think that Labour is nearer to government now than it was 3 years ago?
Yes, I do. I just think it offers a complete alternative to what the Conservative Party are offering. I think Corbyn's kind of grown as leader. I think he says a lot of the right things. I think a lot of the shadow cabinet around him have grown. I know that the Daily Mail, bless them, did a lovely article actually about how diverse Labour's front bench is, and it appeals to more people. The Conservative government as well, being in absolute chaos, it kind of does point people over to Labour.
I think you can also say quite objectively that yes, it is closer to being in government, because we got more seats in 2017 than we had in 2015. Granted, not enough to become the biggest party, not enough to get a majority, but that is an objective fact, which indicates that Labour is closer to getting into power. Being the sad guy I am, I did some breakdown analysis of the results. There is a path to win amongst those seats that are, you know, marginals and all of that. But
we're winning in Canterbury and places like that, and it wasn't even thought was going to happen. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that path does exist, and it is definitely feasible. Whether that is, you know, that getting into government is in the form of being the largest party or getting a majority remains to be seen. But there is a path there, and they just need to find a way to actually map it out. And that really is where my concerns would lie, is have they actually done that? Have they got that thinking in place? So far, I'm not convinced they have, but then we've not got, hopefully, a general election for a good few more years. So
I think they've been briefed, though, that we're always on election standby.
Well, so I think that's very, very sensible, given the febrile state of politics. I think to answer the question, obviously we are close, I think, to winning an election. We've got 40% of the vote. We took the seats, as Steve said, and there's a path to victory. I think there's some challenges that we need to address about how we ensure our policy offer reaches out for those people who didn't vote for us last time.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think we need to do some thinking and some work around communities that have traditionally been with us that clearly didn't follow us as much as they did have in previous elections. So, you know, thinking of some of the seats in Derbyshire, for instance, and places like that where we and the Walsalls where we fell back, and there's work that we need to do there as well.
That's why it's quite good that we've got these new community organisers in the Labour Party that are going to do work in those communities like Walsall and Stoke.
And I think a lot of the policy heavy lifting is being done, actually. I think one of the most unfair criticisms of Corbyn is that he's kind of this nationalisation, take Britain back to the 1970s. That we've talked on the podcast about John McDonnell's proposals for cooperatives. They are talking about cooperatives and alternatives. It's not like top-down nationalisation like maybe it was in the 40s and the 50s. And so I think there is that alternative prospectus. I think, to come back to your earlier point, Nikki, I think Corbyn himself as a politician has grown. So on the Twitter, on Wednesday, we're recording this, that the week, 3 years to the week he was Labour leader. And you look at the speech that he gave after he was first elected leader, when he was obviously nervous and obviously not fully developed as a communicator. On that day, there was PMQs, and having to give that final question. So now the Tory MPs know what Corbyn is trying to do with his final question, which is meant to be that soundbite for the 6 o'clock news on social media. And so they are shouting and bailing. And the way that he was
calling him a racist.
And the way that Corbyn was kind of overcalling them, was going through, was asking those questions and ploughing through. There's no way the Corbyn of 3 years ago could have done that.
He seems a lot more comfortable in what he's saying. When he was joking about Theresa May and her dancing. It's like it just seems like it's comes a lot more natural to him.
It, certainly in terms of PMQs, he's got a lot better, and over the last few weeks he's been wiping the floor with May, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all for this week. If you want to read any more of our stuff in the meantime, our website's notenoughchampagne.com, our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, and our Twitter handle's @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
I'm @councillorjohncotton.
I'm @NikkiEBrennan.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Deppert is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone. We've been talking about Jeremy Corbyn.
He's been called worse.